Welcome to the Second Reading Podcast from the University of Texas at Austin.
The Republicans were in the Democratic Party because there was only one party.
So I tell people on a regular basis, there is still a land of opportunity in America. It's called Texas.
The problem is these departures from the Constitution, they have become the norm.
At what point must a female senator raise her hand or her voice to be recognized over the male colleagues in the room?
And welcome back to the Second Reading Podcast. I'm Jim Henson, director of the Texas Politics Project at the University of Texas at Austin. Happy to be joined again today by my collaborator, co-conspirator, and research director of the Texas Politics Project, not in that order, of course, Joshua Blank. Josh, good morning.
Good morning.
So on last week's podcast, Josh and I were joined by the illustrious Professor Darren Shaw. I used all of his titles last time. I will not do that this time.
I got the title treatment this time.
You got the title treatment in the absence of Professor Shaw.
Yeah, I only heard conspirator. But
so last week, Darren was here so we could do a rollout podcast pegged to the release of our latest UT Texas Politics Project poll, which we conducted in mid to late February. Yeah, that last conversation, you know, and this happens when we have Darren and it's reasonably on purpose. You know, we sort of migrated a lot into national politics or kind of electoral politics to some degree. And that, of course, is Professor Shaw's bread and butter. I bet he doesn't eat a lot of bread and butter, though.
No,
that
he's
guy.
Pretty fit, lean. He's fit, yeah.
This week, we want to drill down into one subject that we touched on towards the end last week, and it came up in a couple of small points, but we're definitely saving it for later, and that subject would be public education. Now, like I said, we plumbed that a little bit last week, and we've been talking about it. But the other thing that was interesting about public education in terms of the approach in the poll was that, you know, as I think we talked about a little bit last week, but it's worth reiterating as people look at the data. You know, we didn't want to get ahead of where the conversation was in a lot of these subject areas. I mean, there were a lot of bills floating around out there, most of which are not going to move.
Right.
Public education, a little bit different than that. I mean, we still don't know, as we'll get into today, exactly what's going to happen by a long shot. But because public education is such a perennial issue, because it's so big.
Yep.
You know, we know, we have a little bit more of an idea of what's out there, and that's reflected in the instrument. So in the instrument, we gave people a list of, what, about 10 possible subjects,
I think.
Yeah,
I think that's right.
Of policy or, you know, and it wasn't even just subjects of policy. It was also, you know, there was a little bit of perspective. Some of it was a little bit of a kind of a subject check in terms of, like, you know, we had parental rights on the list. Yeah. Now, parental rights is not a specific topic area, but it's certainly an area that has some salience to certainly players in the system and also out in the world, in the public, as we saw. And so we did do a little bit more on public ed this time, right? So let's start with the general assessment. So we know that, you know, public education comes up a lot. It's a perennial subject. It's big. It's a big budget item. It's salient. But you've been looking back at some of the data on this, you know, in the long term of the poll and have some nuance in terms of when it's come up, how it's come up, how it's not, et cetera, right?
Right. I'm trying to develop some nuance.
And
this is the beginning of some of that.
This is the pre-nuance.
This is the pre-nuance meeting, right? Okay. So, I mean, you know, that's right. I mean, public education is probably one thing you didn't mention in terms of just sort of why it's kind of always on the agenda is also, you know, somebody's always talking about it. And it may be somebody in the position to put it directly on the agenda, or it may be dissidents in either party or, you know, even the opposition party or whatever, just saying, hey, look.
And this, certainly the interest group community.
The interest group community is always
looms very large.
Always activated. I mean, you know, there are some pretty large educational interest institutions with very close proximity to the Capitol, right?
Yes.
So, ultimately, it's always an agenda item, but, you know, the prominence of it, it changes over time, and we'll kind of get around to this, I think, at the end in some way, because, you know, its salience changes over time. There's always a core group of people. I mean, in some ways, education is kind of like healthcare. Healthcare always comes up in a poll as one of the most important problems facing the country, facing the state. There's a core group of voters who are always going to say healthcare is a major issue. I'm not saying the same voters every time.
And the size, and that, you know, it's perennial but not consistent, and it's in the magnitude of that interest.
Well, I'll say it's not. The magnitude of that interest doesn't vary a lot, though, in the sense that it's usually less than 10% of voters. And that's generally pretty true with education also. Usually less than 10% of voters are going to prioritize education as a major issue unless there's a reason for it to prioritize. For example, the 2011 education cuts, right? The big cuts to education after that financial crisis and, you know, some misestimation about state revenue, et cetera, et cetera.
Misunderestimation. I think it's the definitional moment of misunderestimation by the controller at that time.
Well, it's a funny thing, you know, going back through the point, it's surprising how often we ask people whether they knew who the controller was back in that period.
Right.
But again, it was a thing. So at that point in time, you know, education, we would ask sort of in a list of priorities, right? When we're talking about, you know, what should the legislature focus on? And again, at the beginning of each session, we essentially ask a priority question. In the past, we've done something kind of closed-ended that reflects what the conversation was. More recently, we've gone to open-ended questions to let people tell us what they think the legislature should focus on.
Although not that we want to stop doing that, as long as we're rangy in our podcast.
Yeah, no.
It is interesting that those open-endeds are not too far off of what the closed-ended lists yield us.
No,
I mean, if you compare it to like the MIP or, you know, it's not exactly the same and it's worth doing, but it is kind of interesting.
Well, I'll just say there's some validity in it and that, like, you know, when you look back in time, you see a much greater prominence among Republicans for like limiting spending, worry, concern about the debt. And then you kind of see that over time kind of fall aside. And I mean, like, and that's been reflected in the conversations. Like, I mean, I just think,
and the composition and tone of the party.
Right. So, you know. But the main point is we always see public education is one of the main priorities that people think the legislature should take on, and the tone and the context of that changes. So after 2011, 2013, 2015, we're talking about restoring the cuts to education. Then there's sort of the question in 2015, well, is it enough just to restore the cuts? Do you have to put in more money than you had in before, right? And generally, this led to, and again, like this, you imagine the politics of this, led to a discussion that was like, well, wait a minute, is this really about money? Right?
Yeah.
And so then, you know, we get much more attention to public ed financing in 2017, leading into the 2019 session in which they really take on public ed financing coupled with property tax reduction, a very comfortable space to be in, right? But then after that, you'd say kind of drops off the main agenda to some extent. In 2021, you've got COVID, you've got the grid collapse, you've got election legislation after sort of all this action was taken in 2019, right? So all of this takes place, right? This is sort of the arc we're kind of going on getting to this point. It takes place in, you know, really generally lukewarm at best overall evaluations of the quality of the public education system, which I think as a public opinion person is interested in all this. You know, what we should focus on kind of shifts over time, kind of shifts around. We'll talk about why maybe, you know, some of these financing things are maybe more salient than some of these other things. But then when we say, well, hey, how would you rate the public ed system? You know, we've asked this, I think, you know, it looks like at least, you know, 10 or 12 times since 2013. And at no point has more than 1 in 10 voters said that the system's excellent.
Right.
And generally, it looks more like 1 in 20. You know, the plurality response is that it's good, right? But there's more people who say it's not very good or terrible than usually say that it's good. And so, you know, it's sort of this interesting kind of overall dynamic.
And they those numbers just don't move very much over time.
No, they don't move very much over time. Now, I should say this. There is something that's important to establish here, which is that this is we're asking about assessments of the system as a whole. When we ask parents specifically about their kids' schools, the evaluations almost always go up significantly. So if I say, and that's again, even if I say to a parent, how do you think the public school system in Texas is? Again, very few are going to say it's excellent. How is your kid's school? Oh, it's excellent. Teachers are great. We love it.
Right.
For the most part. Now, look, there's some data that indicates that that's been, you know, changing potentially a little bit over time, but not a ton. So.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that, you know, just a stray comment on the overall kind of, you know, the fat part of that distribution. And again, we would expect this, you know, we asked that question. We say, is it excellent, good, not very good, terrible?
Right.
Right. And, you know, the numbers for good and not very good are remarkably stable and account for, you know, three quarters consistently throughout this time series, between 7 and 8 of 10. But I, you know, as I'm sitting here, it reminds me of, and I think her thinking has changed on this, and I don't want to hold her to this. And if she hears this, she can call me and come on the show. But Erica Greeter's book, Red Hot and Cheap.
No, it's.
Isn't that right?
Yeah.
Now, I think that's about.
It's. I think Wright is in the title, too.
Yeah, maybe so.
And Wright. It's and Wright, right?
Because, I Well, I don't know. I think it's just Red Hot and Cheap, but we'll look it up during the break.
Okay.
At any rate, Erica's book on Texas, I mean, in some ways she made the argument that, yeah, the Texas schools were not terrible. They weren't great. And that's probably about where the median point was for where the public was fairly satisfied with that. These numbers sort of weigh that argument out. I mean, there are other ways I might, you know, one might, you know, quibble with that argument, but it's kind of there. So what is that book?
It's Big, Hot, Cheap, and Right, What America Can Learn from the Strange Genius of Texas. I'm sure you can get it in any of your favorite booksellers.
Yes.
Barnes & Noble, Amazon.
Had a red cover anyway.
It had a red cover, yes.
Okay, well,
I knew the right did two things on that.
Good real-time fact-checking on Erica Greeter's book. And Erica's now a columnist for the Houston Chronicle if you want to look Erica's stuff up. And so I think, you know, that's an interesting piece of this. So let's then talk about spending, since that's
right.
Kind of underlying this. And so in this last poll, we asked a battery of questions where we asked people to evaluate whether the state was spending too much, too little, or about the right amount on, I think on this thing, it was about a dozen issue areas. And so we have two results from that, because we have everybody assess it individually, and then we have a top priority? No, we don't have a top priority on this one. That's why it was so hard to present this graphically. So we have all these comparative kind of standards of how much people should spend. And the spending results on education were, I think, revealing to some degree.
Yeah, I mean, I think—
And this was K-12 public education was the wording.
Right, and the idea with a question like this is not because we think people have, you know, some sense of, like, the distribution of the last budget cycle or anything like that. That's not the idea.
In fact, it's because we assume they don't.
Yeah, we assume they don't. But the idea here is this is really about, you know, your perception of state investment in the areas. Are they doing enough? Are they not doing enough? Right?
Yeah.
And that's, or are they doing the right amount? And that's the idea here. And so, and again, this is sort of, you know, this is a reasonable way to ask people about budgetary priorities, right? To get these perceptions.
Yeah, that respects the fact that large numbers don't really mean anything to people.
Right. And so it's just the question of this perception. And again, this is important because we're talking about politics, right?
Yeah.
So perceptions matter. So overall, when we ask this question, only 12% of Texans think that we're spending too much on K-12 public education. Almost half, 48%, say we're spending too little, with about a third saying about the right amount and 12% saying, yeah, I have no idea, right? But the main point is about half say we're spending too little on public ed. Now, not surprisingly, it's driven to some extent, though not entirely, by Democrats. So 71% of Democrats say we're spending too little on education compared to 27% of Republicans. It's not as though Republicans overall think we're spending too much on public education. Only 17% do. Most, the plurality, 42%, say think we're spending about the right amount, which is, I should say, pretty common Republican response to the spending items. It's a pretty safe place to be if you're basically happy with the direction of government, the distribution of resources. You say, yeah, this is about right. Then when we look at it compared to everything else, what we basically find is K-12 public education in the middle of the pack. Of those 12 items, you know, in terms of where Texans think we're spending too little. So the thing that, you know, what topped the list, mental health services. And this is consistent. This is bipartisan, right? Not surprising. It attaches to a lot of different issues, actually.
Yeah.
Electric infrastructure was next. Again, that's mostly driven by Democrats, but actually there's a lot of Republicans who are, you know, I think not uninterested.
Yeah. A little more conscious of keeping the lights on than they might have been 5 years ago.
Yeah. And I should say, you know, I mean, to the main point here, There's an extent to which the too little responses are going to be driven by Democrats, who overwhelmingly see the state as spending too little on most of these issues. So it's going to reflect Democratic priorities, right? Healthcare comes next, for example, but then water infrastructure, then children in the state's care, which is a pretty, you know, big issue area if you've been following it. And it's good that at least, you know, there's a fair number of people
yes.
who kind of see that. And then K-12 public education comes in the middle. It's only higher than the environment. You know, transportation, I'm going to put a pin in border security for a second.
Yeah.
Higher ed, broadband access, which is interesting. I'll say, you know, there's a bill released the other day talk of a lot of significant investments in broadband access. And broadband
There was a broadband and a water bill dropped this week.
Right. And broadband access is kind of down
the
list.
House, you know, on the House side, we should say.
Right. And at the very bottom is prisons. So, I mean, K-12 public education, kind of in the middle, definitely driven mostly by Democrats, but not something that people are necessarily, and I'll say that Republicans are necessarily saying, oh, you need to put money into the system right now.
Yeah, I mean, not to overinterpret the data, which we're always advising people not to do. But I mean that, I find that 42% of Republicans saying we're spending about the right amount pretty significant. I mean, as we have this multifaceted, you know, to broaden the discussion where we're kind of heading today, is we have this multifaceted conversation about public education. To the extent that spending is a part of that, given the money that is out there available, given the budget surplus, you know, you're just not going to find a lot of takers among Republicans for the argument that, okay, we also need to, you know, increase spending on public ed. And this, you know, this is not news. I mean, there's a common conservative argument that, you know, public school problems in part, and this is more traditional, we're in a kind of a new twist that we'll talk about in a minute, but the, you know, traditionally there has been an argument that the problems in public schools are not about the amount of money, it's about how it's spent.
Right.
You know, you can, you know, for those of you on Twitter, I mean, it is a common trope for particularly, just to be fair, public school funding out, you know, voucher type advocates or, you know, critics of the public schools, you know, to remind people that there are overpaid superintendents and, you know, too many facilities and, you know, too many, you know, thumb twiddling administrators, et cetera, et cetera. So this is not, it's not surprising, but I think it is worth noting that there is a receptive public audience for those arguments. Again, we get into the, you know, chicken egg issue here,
well,
but
and you know what, and the thing
it's
is,
out there.
Well, and there's a better avenue, which is, you know, which is property tax reduction. So if you are, you know, a Republican legislator and you want to put more money into the public education system, you know, in some ways you get a twofer if you go and actually lower property taxes,
right?
And then basically, you know, at the very least, commit to making that up in the overall funding formulas on the state side, right? And then you get to say, not only did I lower property taxes, but I increased funding to your public school system, which again, not really going to hurt you in most cases.
Right.
But to your point, I mean, we've asked about this before. And I mean, you know, the share of Democrats who see increasing funding in the system as being an effective way to improve the system is significantly higher than the share of Republicans who agree with that. And so that's kind of important to address, especially in the context of kind of some of the big issues. And I guess we move to that next, which is sort of you know, what's important. And the two things that top the list as sort of, you know, most important in terms of for the legislature to address in K through 12 public education were number one, school safety, number two, teacher pay and retention. And so it's interesting because on the one hand, you've got teacher pay and retention pretty high up the list, pretty down, you know, far down the list is public school financing at this point, which again used to be, if it were 2015, 2016, that might be a lot higher, right? But now we're talking about this, but it's weird to kind of decouple those things, right?
Right, exactly. And, you know, and just to flesh out that list, you know, to get where we're going, I mean, to set up the, before we break it down into party, we'll give, you know, kind of spoiler alert. So, you know, the top item, as you said, was school safety at 29%. Second was teacher pay, teacher retention at 21%. Third was something that we explained to the respondents as curriculum content, that is what students are taught. And then ninth, as I sort of foreshadowed, was the fourth with 9% was parental rights.
Right.
Right. And then given the conversation, we should say, then the fifth response was vouchers, educational savings accounts, or other school choice legislation, and we phrased it that way, at 8%. And then you break that up, and the partisan structure looks very familiar to what we're seeing right now, right?
Right, where basically, you know, about two-thirds of Democrats would prioritize school safety or teacher pay, pretty much even proportions. And so that generates, you know, most of the Democratic response, with curriculum content coming in a closer. Now, again, what Democrats mean by curriculum content and what Republicans mean by curriculum content likely means different things.
Right.
But you would say the fat part of, you know, the Democratic Party on this is on school safety and teacher pay. And I would say if school safety weren't so salient right now because of Uvalde,
right,
you know, teacher pay would be dominating that list.
Right. And I think, you know, it's interesting to step back for a second. I mean, to go back to, you know, you sort of, I think you flagged this to come back to, and we should just come back to it now, which is if you look at the priority of school safety among both Democrats and Republicans, you look at the priority on mental health.
Right.
And not that mental health is driven entirely by the aftermath of the Uvalde shooting, but, you know, all our polling or the, you know, the extensive polling that we've done on gun safety and particularly on school shootings suggest that, you know, a lot of Texans of both parties think that mental health is a big part of the explanation for those kinds of events. And it is, you know, interesting to note how much that is rippling through these preferences without, you know, without us saying, hey, in the context of the school shooting, what do you think?
Right.
We didn't contextualize either of the questions that we got these responses on. They were more general questions. And it is interesting to see that diffusion of the impact of the shooting that is consistent with some of the immediate polling we did that saw these as, you know, areas where there was bipartisan, you know, some bipartisan interest or the attitudes were not night and day like they are on another, you know, to my mind, equally obvious part of the explanation, which is gun safety.
Right. You know, and this is why we did this the way we did it, right? I mean, to your point, you know, you've gone through the list of how we kind of laid out these priorities. And the point is, you know, I say this, is like, you know, the term of the day, I guess. You know, think about levels of conceptualization. We're talking about broad issue areas that might be important.
Right.
We're not saying a law that would do X, a law that would do Y, because ultimately there are no laws right now.
Yeah.
And to your point, you said something earlier, you know, there may be, there are probably, you know, dozens, if not many dozens of bills that are filed right now meant to address school safety in different ways.
Yeah.
And only a couple of them are really going to move forward in any significant way.
Right. And so I think as you look at this,
Go ahead. Well, I was going to say, if we're done with the gun piece of this, I mean, let's go back to the politics of this, right? So just to go back and then move forward, right? So for Democrats, the vast majority are focused on school safety and teacher pay. I 100% agree with you. I mean, I think the way that school safety and mental health and what we know about violence attitudes, like that is a really solid cluster, again, especially for Republican leadership to operate in, because you're going to be solving the problem as viewed mostly by Republican voters, but by a large number of independents and even, you know, a significant number of Democrats in the mental health space. If we look at Republicans, you know, 1-4 say school safety should be the top priority. But so on the one hand, you say, OK, but there's a big but here, right? An equal share say curriculum content, right? And if we take curriculum content and add to that the share who say parental rights, which I think we can talk about whether that makes sense or not, we get to 43%. Sorry, 42%.
Yeah.
If we add the people who say vouchers, right, now we're at 56%. And now this is sort of the question. Does that make sense, right? Should you bundle all the things together? I think you can from a politics standpoint.
Yeah.
From a policy standpoint, it's going to be more challenging. And I mean, this kind of comes down to this sort of the ultimate question, I think, you know, that kind of that these results bring up to me, which is, you know, what's going to be enough for the Republican legislature to accomplish in public ed, and what kinds of things will be enough to be able to say some effective mission accomplished, or we move the ball forward significantly. And there's a challenge here. I mean, I think in all ways, you know, curriculum content as discussed by Republicans, parental rights and vouchers and school choice are really kind of about, in general, dissatisfaction with the way the public education system is going. The problem is that the former two are about parents who have their kids in the schools right now, and, the latter is about parents who do not and don't intend to or want to. And those are like, and just from a policy standpoint, those are different things.
Yeah. I mean, I think the big question is, you know, one of the big questions for how the legislature moves forward on this and how the politics play out is how coherently those things can be stitched together.
Right.
Right. Does it look, you know, I think to Democrats, it looks a little bit more like you're building a Frankenstein's monster. To Republicans, you have a little bit more potential for building this line of argument that we've been talking about,
right.
And we'll come back. And I'm not forgetting about the parents, non-parents thing,
right.
The kids in the school. But yeah, I mean, I think you know the argument here to me is how in stark political terms, from the legislative perspective, is how successful can you be?
Mm-hmm.
At turning what has been marketed for the most part as an argument about quote unquote school choice, which, you know, we're not supposed to say vouchers anymore from the perspective of advocates, but school choice is still very much, you know, the term of choice, even if it is a term of art here. Mm-hmm. How much can you move that discussion, which has not been able to gain a Republican majority in the House of Representatives, to be as concrete about it as possible? Can you take that argument, expand it with what we're seeing in these numbers by recoding education, if you will, for Republicans as about parental rights, as about not the effectiveness of the public schools, but their role, their ideological role and their cultural role in Texas right now? And will that create enough pressure on heretofore reluctant legislators? To me, that's the question in this space right now.
Right.
You know, I know you want to flesh that out with it, but I mean, I think, you know, so the argument comes up is, well, you know, I mean, the argument that legislators are making, this is a little bit of a diversion here, but, you know, I think rural legislators, if you look back at the rural numbers on public funds for private schools.
Small numbers.
They're small, but, you know, generally it's not like the pattern in the legislature replicates itself in public opinion. And what I mean by that is, you know, having gone back and looked at a few of these, you know, it's never as clearly cut that rural voters are saying, oh, yeah, we don't have any choices here, so we can't, you know.
Right.
And so, you know, so you can see where I'm going with this. But nonetheless, the legislators have not been persuaded by that. And this is an area where, you know, it goes back to kind of the classic formulation of representative government. Do you want me to, like, represent exactly what you think you want, or do you want me to use my judgment to represent your interests? And in many ways, it's like the classic, you know, Edmund Burke dilemma here. In a lot of ways, rural legislators have been acting as trustees rather than delegates, strictly speaking, if you look at their at Republican public opinion, near as I recall it in looking at those rural numbers. I mean, I think I've always been a little surprised, like, oh, let's see what the rural numbers on choice. Well,
yeah,
you know, there's not like rural, you know, rural voters are not going en masse, hey, we don't have choices here. You know, some are saying, yeah, that we should be able to do that. Others are not. And part of that is probably age in what's going on in these rural areas. But the pregnant question to me here is, does this recoding, I mean, I think, you know, Governor Abbott keeps saying, you know, this should be about, you know, education, not indoctrination in the public schools. You know, I've kind of been thinking about that in a slightly pivoted way, which is, you know, we're moving from a discussion that has been keyed relatively unsuccessfully for advocates to we want to give you school choice to now we want to give you ideological and cultural choice.
Right.
Will that get them over?
Yeah, and I mean, the thing about this, you know, to your point, yeah, I mean, I just, in a response to sort of your read of the voucher support numbers, you know, and it's one of those things where, you know, education, I'm, this is sort of an interesting thing because we, you know, apparently a lot of ways we can go with this.
Yeah.
But education doesn't translate super well into public opinion because, yes, I agree. I think there's a lot more ambivalence about vouchers out there in the data than I think, you know, than the legislature reflects in the way that discussion goes, right?
Yeah.
But this is where you kind of have to ask about, like, you know, salience and intensity of these opinions, right? And centrality is the other thing, right? Not only, like, how much are you thinking about it, how intensely do you feel about it, but also, like, how central is it to your political identity, right, in some kind of ways? And I'll say this. If you are a, you know, if you work in a public school system in a rural county, it's probably a pretty big part of your identity. It might be kind of a part of the town's identity in some ways, you know. And so for the people who care about this issue on either side, they care intensely, right? So you're talking about the employees who have a direct stake in it. You have public school parents who are ideologically committed to the system. And then you've got, you know, again, a large community of homeschool and alternative school. People want to just send their kids to different schools, right? But nonetheless, Texas is huge.
Right. Well, and you so also have another group that we have to mention, which is you don't have a, you know, you're not directly interested. You neither work for a school district. Your livelihood is not connected or.
Yeah, well, but that's everybody else.
Yeah, that's everyone else.
Right. So, I mean, like, I can have a kid in the public school system. In our survey, you know, when we ask, you know, do you have a kid in the public school system? It's about 20% of the registered voters we survey. So about 1 in 5 say they have a kid in the public school. Some, infinitesimally small group of people, you know, work in the public school systems in terms of Texas
numerically.
Right.
Yes.
An even smaller numerical number of people homeschool their kids or take, you know, probably take advantage of school choice options that already exist. But those people care a lot. But they are very small. And so what you end up having is you end up having survey results, let's say, on vouchers, where I would say, you know, and again, I really am so reluctant to dismiss a survey result to say, well, these people don't, like, yeah, they say this, but they don't, you know, I mean, I don't think they feel right. strongly about it. But in public education, I think we have precedent for this. We go back to the public education cuts of 2011. We asked repeatedly about perceptions of, you know, quality in the system, whether there were changes, whether the funding changes mattered, all these things. And we wrote a blog post way back in the day about the dog that, you know, didn't bark, right?
Right.
In the sense of, you know, everyone was saying, oh, you're going to hear about this, about all these public education cuts. And then ultimately people made do, they moved on. And most people, especially most voters, don't have kids in the public school system. They're not interfacing with it in any direct way. And so there is just a limit in some of this. But,
well, I mean, I guess I think about it a little bit. Well, finish the thought.
Well, and I was just going to, well, I don't want to, you know, I'll say where I was going to go and then you can decide if you want to go that way or not. I was going to say, you know, so I mean, I think it's important to think about people's interface with the system in a really fundamental way and kind of understanding what's going on here. You know,
right.
I think we've talked about this before, the nature of like the size of House districts versus the size of state Senate districts, you know, those kinds of things. We've gone over this on the podcast. But if we look at voters now, you know, we can look at sort of, you know, voters who may have, you know, more of an interface with the system and voters who don't. We can just by looking at age groups, right?
Yeah.
So should I go into this or you think?
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah, let's do that.
So, you know, if we look at that the education priority by parties, we look among Republicans, let's say first, and we look at voters under 44 and those who are over 45 plus. If we look first of all at Republican voters over the age of 45, curriculum content is the number one issue, 28%. So almost one in three, then school safety, then parental rights, then vouchers. If we look at the Republican voters under the age of 44, the top issue is school safety, 35%, then parental rights, then curriculum content. And so, you know, I mean, it's a rearrangement of the thing. It's kind of their minor pieces of this, but you say, okay, you know, that makes sense, right? And it's the first thing, right? Like what is my, you know, what do I want? Well, I want the kids to be safe because I have kids in the school. And again, I'm not saying that older voters don't want the kids to be safe,
yeah.
But you can have a more abstract attachment to what we're talking about here. Now, if we say, you know, if we look just at people who actually have kids in the public schools, the first thing they say is, again, school safety and then teacher pay. And that's 55% right there of public school parents who are voters in Texas. Again, direct interface. Do they have teachers? Are they safe? Next, curriculum content, next, parental rights, which together add up to 20%.
Right. So, I mean, to me, I mean, and, you know, we've got, and we won't go into all the numbers, but we've also got numbers where you broke it down by, you know, 44 and under and 45 and over. And it shows a similar pattern that makes the point. And I guess, you know, what I was going to say, and it's good to have the data in front of us, is, you know, the way I kind of think about this in my own kind of macro level way of thinking about these things, which one could say is, you know, whatever, loosey-goosey, but, or maybe, well, anyway, we won't use the other adjectives. I'm not sure I'm allowed to use those words in a public institution anymore. But, you know, if you've got this direct investment in the way that you were laying out or this direct experiential connection with the public school system or children or, you know, the education, education is a process.
Right.
You're going to have a different affect and a different set of priorities, a different, you know, however you, attitudinal response, then if it's more abstract and there are other things filling it in. And what I was going to jump in and say is, like, so if you don't have that direct connection, then the question is, what else fills in that attitudinal space when somebody says, hey, what do you think about this?
Yeah.
Right? And if you're not thinking, and I think this really illustrates that. And look, the population, you know, if Republicans now have a lot of other material that has been that has been directly articulated by opinion leaders and elected officials and, you know, partisan media, frankly.
Right.
That says, hey, here's a bunch of information or here's a bunch of ways of framing public education that makes sense to them. And that's why we're seeing that, you know, curriculum content, parental rights.
Right.
You know, these, you know, and then, you know, once you put those two things in the hopper, maybe what comes out of that is, you know, maybe we do need alternatives to these institutions. And to me, what's a little bit ironic in the big historical intellectual sense is, you know, this is kind of like, oh, you know what? You know, institutions have a real impact on socializing people.
Turns out.
You know, and you know, there aren't these you know, we need to pay attention to institutions as battlegrounds. And, you know, this is no big insight, and we've seen, but it's part of a larger, to my mind, kind of realization kind of the putting into action politically an intellectual point about the role of institutions and the use of institutions to political ends that is very interesting and a little bit different than what we think of as classic conservative thought.
Yeah. And I mean, and I think, you know, and I think what you said there really just lays out in some ways, you know, I mean, in some ways why this issue has changed. I mean, again, vouchers is moving into this. That's sort of what's so interesting to me about this discussion is the way that, you know, in some ways, you know, as you've been laying out, you know, parental rights and this idea about curriculum, you know, again, they connect with vouchers in an interesting way. But nonetheless, you know, how you mobilize this issue politically, you know, is, I think, is a pretty big challenge.
Well, I mean, so, I think it's
and for both sides.
Yeah, no, I think that's
right. I mean, you laid out sort of the, you know, we're talking about, like, you know, basically in some ways, you know, playing to conservative voters. And when I say conservative, I just mean, you know, generally conservative. I'm not even talking about like ideologues here, but playing to conservative voters' sensibilities about, you know, let's say the primacy of, you know, whatever, American exceptionalism. Let's put that out there as one thing. You know, and
well, sort of heteronormativity.
Heteronormativity. We can go down the list. General, you know, but again, like, you know, but about this sort of
just shoot me now.
But commitment. But let's just say a commitment to an ideological worldview and about, you know, the role that education is playing and the continuation of it. Look, that is pretty abstract. And for Democrats too. I mean, just to be fair here, you know, you're sitting here saying no. Listen, our Democratic voters, they are very committed to the public education system. Yeah. They do not want money going to you know, let's say to a parochial institution. It's like, and you say, what's parochial mean?
I guess that's what's interesting to me about it. That's the point. I mean, in a way, you're getting at the point I was getting at it in a different way, which is that, you know, I guess what I'm marveling at here a little bit is the very concrete operationalization of the realization that public education institutions, take a deep breath, are basically the means of ideological reproduction, right? So, you know, I mean, like, you know, these things are big fights, you know, and so we're either going to, you know, I mean, it's a two-front battle now, you know, I mean, if you want to be fair on both sides, right, in which what is taught in the public schools, and not just the content of curriculum, but the cultural norms are worth fighting over. Yeah. And the two-front battle right now, particularly among, you know, conservatives and a lot of conservatives is we're either going to, at the same time, we're going to try to change what's going on inside the public schools, but we're also going to weaken the institutions and create alternatives to that.
Right.
And, you know, that's to me, that's the game that's afoot right now. And I'm not, it's a rational strategy from that point of view, at least in the short run. But I think that is the stakes of what we're looking at right now.
Yeah. And then I would say, you know, take a step back and kind of like sum up, you know, some of that, you know, and put it in, you know, this into the full context here, right? So if you're going to kind of, we're kind of getting to the end here, say, you know, so while school safety and, like, you know, the shortage in teachers is going to continue to receive a bunch of attention and, you know, the teacher shortage retention thing could push itself onto the agenda by force at some point, depending on what happens with that, right? But like these kind of, well, I just mean like, you know, I mean like, yeah. You know, and this was going on, I mean, you know, you can imagine like if schools can't like operate, you know, there's problems, yeah. Right? But, you know, these sort of, you know, educational campaign issues of the kind of 2022, I think they're going to get higher billing. And there's two reasons for that. Again, where the center of Republican attitudes are on this, which is, you know, not with putting more money in the system or tinkering with the financing, but really in these sort of culture war issues, right? And just generally, you know, in some ways, again, acknowledging the indoctrinating effects of the institutions, right? But in some ways, they can probably get, I mean, you know, I would say one could probably get away with just addressing those things and not addressing, you know, I would say teacher pay or financing the system and maybe even not school safety in a terribly extensive way because of all the things we're talking about. Because the things that people who really care about it care, those are the things. And for everybody else, it's kind of abstract.
Right.
And so that's not, you know, is it going to supplant border security for Republicans as the top issue?
Yeah.
No.
Yeah, not a chance.
You know, and ultimately, unless, you know, the bills that the legislature eventually passes having to do with public education just fundamentally offend the vast majority of Democrats, which they will on their face, but also do so in an intense way, which I think seems unlikely.
Right.
then there's still going to be the same range of issues that Democrats are interested in, including education, but also gun safety and also healthcare and also the climate.
Well, I mean, I think what's, yeah, I mean, as we're talking about this, I mean, I think what's interesting, or one of the things that's interesting about this is that, you know, that's at the intersection of, you know, the internal process and politics of the legislature and public opinion is the context of that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, public opinion sort of filtering in some ways is that it's easy to conceptualize this in the public education space in the way that we've been talking about to some degree. But then there are these other external things that, you know, are bound to enter into it because of the way the legislative process works and the messiness and lack of, you know, sharpness, if you will, in public attitudes, which is if we were just going to have this fight and it was going to be just about the kind of way I've been reducing it, about like, okay, what are we doing in the public schools? What right. is the role of the public school? Who controls the institutions? Who controls like how, you know, what they're doing in their core functions? But there are these other elements that are entering into it, yeah. right? The deflection of, or, you know, the desire to demonstrate action on school violence without talking about guns.
Right.
So all of a sudden, you know, we're talking about increased funding conceivably for school safety and facilities and all of this. Other elements that are part of the larger conversation that are also buffeting this, you know, I mean, obviously property taxes.
Yeah, sure.
And so I think it does bring out the way that they're connected in the way that, you know, this is, you know, even if we were just going to look at, think about, okay, we're just going to silo this. This is going to be, I mean, this is completely hypothetical, non-realistic, stylized example. But, okay, this is going to be the session where, you know what, the main priority, no matter what, is going to be public education.
Mm-hmm.
We are going to sit here and we are going to have a serious, focused conversation that is fact-based and evidence-based and blah, 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 where everybody's time is going to be spent on this. It's a stylized example because all these other things would still be connected
to it. Well, and then you'd say, to do what?
Yeah, right.
Right, and that's a big...
Well, but that would be
the big question.
But that would also clarify, you know, that would be the clarifying effect of that stylized, non-realistic exam. But it's also why we're not going to have it.
No, but you know what's great? but I think that stylized, non-realistic example is probably a pretty good way to think about what's going to happen.
Yeah.
Because when you get to that endpoint and say, well, okay, we're meeting to have this conversation to do what? And is it to fix the way we finance the system? Is it to make it the best system of any of the states, you know, in the country? Is it to deal with the fact, you know, again, that that there's a feeling out there that's pretty widespread that the schools are indoctrinating the students in the wrong kind of way?
Right.
Well, you know what? I think that's going to be the winner.
Yeah.
Right?
I
mean, but that's the point there. If that's the winner, well, then that kind of tells you where we should expect, you know, things to go. And so, I mean, one of the things is, you know, I don't like to make predictions, which is terrible. But, you know, there is sort of, you think about what do you expect to have happen here. I mean, I think there's, you know, if we go down the session and say, you know, where is public education spending its time and resources and energy? I expect a lot of time and resources and energy to be spent in this space.
Yeah, whether it succeeds or not, certainly it's going
to
be there.
You know, what's interesting, I just want to add one thing about the polling just to go, you know, in the arc of it. But, you know, you mentioned this idea of, you know, the institution is sort of the indoctrinator and all that kind of stuff. And it's funny because, you know, right now there's a sort of—
We can say agent of socialization if we want to be
please,
more social science-y,
do
I guess.
Do what you want to do.
But whatever.
But, you know, it's interesting. We're at a point now where basically the question is, you know, what kind of standards, limits, guardrails is the state going to put on, you know, the ISDs, the many, many ISDs in the schools across the state, right, as it relates to, you know, how students are taught about, you know, especially sensitive topics. What's interesting is when you go back in the polling, you know, in sort of the last decade and think about this discussion, you look at the priorities people, you know, ascribe to education. And what used to be a popular priority for Republican voters was letting the local school districts make basically curriculum decisions. That was a big discussion that was going on for a while about, you know, this happened to do with graduation requirements. They tried to localize a lot of graduation
right.
requirement, you know, issues. But this was, you know, this ongoing idea of like, you know, and again, I mean, local control always pops its head up in these weird ways. And again, you can't, you know, again, we'll caveat and put aside the discussion of race and all this for, you know, three other podcasts some other time. But, you know, that was where the discussion was in some ways, was, well, maybe we should give the districts more control so that they can, you know, deal with their parents and their, you know, norms and that kind of thing. And it didn't really go anywhere, but it's interesting now that, you know, a few years later, you come back and say, no, we should tell everybody exactly what
yeah.
the rules of the road are.
Well, you know, and I would argue, yeah, that's a sign of an embrace of, you know, managing institutional control to some degree. But I think the other thing, I mean, it's funny as you say that. I mean, it kind of underlines the point of just how, you know, abstract it is, you know, to isolate these things. The other thing I was going to throw in there was, you know, something else in the poll that I think, you know, maybe this is putting a pin for, you know, one of the upcoming podcasts, is that the state's growth is not a trivial consideration here. Because when you talk about spending, you know, we may be spending the right amount, but if we're spending the right amount per pupil, even, then we need to increase spending.
Yeah, I mean, I have a note in here that I'll just say it out loud. You know, it's really easy to spend a lot on public education without spending enough.
Yeah,
Depending on what your goals are.
Because you have to spend a lot just to keep up with where the state is right now, and that is another – but, you know, as soon as you bring that in, it raises a bunch of these questions. You know, the questions about race that you raise.
About equity, about –
you know, the questions about control, all of these kinds of things. Also, you can't really keep out a bunch of these other contextual –
well, that's a great place to end this podcast in some ways, right? Because on the one hand, you've got a push by, you know, really in many ways, you know, an ideological drive to that's really being driven by, in many ways, older, whiter voters, right, and a public education system that is dominated by non-white young Texans.
Yeah.
And so to the extent that this is, you know, in a lot of ways about woke ideology, you know, and you think about, again, you know, gender identity differences by age group and things like that. I mean, you're just talking about, this is why, you know, yeah, this can happen this session, but you know what? It's not. We're going to come back to this and again and again and again because the system and, you know, sort of these things are in a clear collision course with each other, I mean, if not already colliding, right?
Yeah, you don't have to scratch very hard at the construct of woke ideology to get to that point.
Right.
Uncomfortable fact of the situation, I think, for some people. With that, thanks again to our excellent production team in the Dev Studio in the College of Liberal Arts here at the University of Texas at Austin. The data we talked about and the blog post archive you can find at texaspolitics.utexas.edu. Thanks to Josh for being here and all his work on this. Thank you for listening, and we'll be back soon with another Second Reading podcast. The Second Reading podcast is a production of the Texas Politics Project at the University of Texas at Austin.